Author of a week on Radio Gorgeous.
Magda Szczebanski.
Yeah.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Lovely to be here.
Absolutely. Our readers, listeners, love books. Your memoir, Reckoning.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Thank you.
Very revealing.
Yeah.
And I have to say, and I hope you won't be offended, I was absolutely shocked at how incredibly beautifully written it was.
Oh, thank you. That's no, that's not a horrible thing for me to hear. It would be, if you,
it was crap.
That would hurt. How dare you say that?
But yeah, the thing was I didn't realize that most of your performance work you've written.
Yeah, yeah.
So that you are...
Yeah, language is my thing, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You are a performer,
yeah.
But you are a writer.
Thanks. Well, I was saying to someone before, I didn't know that I was going to come out with this book, and it was a little bit like, you know when a dog farts and they do that, did I do that? I had a little bit like that feeling I didn't know that was really in there. I had a tiny little sense maybe, but, you know, just goes to show if you give yourself a bit of time and space and take out a loan and turn down work, you never know what you'll find.
You might be homeless. You might have written a book.
Yeah.
Who can say?
It's in the lap of the gods. Yeah.
And why did you decide to turn to this now?
I think it's one of those age things. You get to a certain age and, you know, another Polish friend of mine will say it's kind of like you spend the first half of your life assimilating and running from the trauma, and then at a certain point you stop and go, what the frick was that? What went down? And years of therapy, you know. So I just kind of had all these phrases in my head, and then when my dad died, it just really started just kind of pouring out of me, and I kind of couldn't stop it. So it was like a dam that burst, really, in some respects. But that to say, I mean, I've got the other job. You know, I'm an actor in Australia, and so that takes up a lot of time because I've, you know, I'm fortunate to have never been out of work. But it meant that it was written over a period of 8 years. But really, seriously, there would be periods of 2 years or more where I didn't do anything on it. But I think I was kind of thinking about it all the time. So yeah,
it spans your life to date.
Yeah.
And starts off the shape of it. I mean, your father's death, I think, did kickstart it.
Yeah.
As you say.
Yeah.
And reckoning is, we all live in the shadow of our parents.
Yeah.
And in the shadow of their decisions.
Yeah.
And you confront that very full on.
Well, not just their decisions, but, you know, it's history too. We're all sort of crushed by those big wheels of history turning, aren't we? You know, and people make decisions in the middle of that. You know, sometimes, you know, I don't even know how much they make decisions and how much decisions are made for them. But certainly the book is, it's very much about intergenerational trauma, which is kind of the easy way of saying it, you know, but it's the flow on effect particularly those two world wars, really, the First and the Second World War, that global conflagrations, there's no one on the planet who isn't the product of that. And I think we're kind of that generation that are mopping up, you know, we're sort of stopping the cycle, I think, and we have the benefit of therapy and particularly trauma therapy to try and understand what's going on. And so there was that, and I really did feel it was very important to honour the courage of my Polish family who fought in the resistance and hid Jewish people. And Poland was the only country where the official penalty for hiding a Jew was the death sentence. And, you know, they would have been tortured if they were caught. And I think it's, you know, it just doesn't feel right to me to not acknowledge what they did. So, yeah.
And so let's be more specific. Your father,
yeah,
is Polish.
Yes.
And was 19 at the outbreak.
15 when the war began, yeah. But he was 19. He was, at the age of 19, he was recruited to be an assassin in a top secret counterintelligence unit working for the Polish resistance, executing Polish collaborators and hiding Jewish people. So, but my whole family were involved in the resistance. And really the book is, you know, it's kind of about me, but I find myself the most boring thing in it. You know, I'm interested in me insofar as seeing the sort of the forces that work through me, you know, as a part of a family saga, but, and certainly the celebrity aspect of my life, I'm like, I could care less about, but, you know, that I find family absolutely fascinating in the way that, it all just sort of rolls on through us. And even I think, genetically, I suspect a lot more stuff I think is passed on the DNA than just your eye color and
I recently found my biological parents laying in bed next to her, and I was like, "Hey, we have the same thumb." And now, like, as if it stops there. So that's your father's side of the family.
Yeah.
But then there's your mother's whole side of the family.
Yeah, which was, it was really interesting because there was such a sort of deep understanding that they had, and I instinctively, intuitively felt there was a terrible sort of trauma and sadness that kind of counterpoised my father. You know, they were like one of those executive toys, just perfectly balanced, you know. And there's a program called Who Do You Think You Are? And I knew very little about my Irish grandfather, my mum's father, except that he was shell-shocked from the war and that he had maybe one or two brothers and sisters. And it turned out that he had 12 brothers and sisters, 10 of whom died, this is living children, died of poverty and disease. And he had a hellish life. I mean, it was Angela's ashes, but really quite a lot worse.
Grimmer.
Yeah. And then the only way to escape, he and his friends tried to crack the safe at the Protestant church, of which we are enormously proud. Being Irish, they failed. And he was caught and sent to prison. And then once he got out of prison, the only option was to join the British Army. And then the military researcher, actually from Who Do You Think You Are, found out that he had been sent, because we didn't know where he'd fought, he'd been sent to the Somme in Passchendaele, which is sort of a byword for hell on earth, really. A lot of British soldiers fought there, absolutely horrific. And the poor man had terrible shell shock. So my mother is sort of like this nexus between her father. She was like purpose-built to deal with a war-traumatised man because she'd grown up with her father, you know. And she has all the classic symptoms of second-generation PTSD, you know, hypervigilant, irritable, emotional, anxiety, depression, all of that. So that's the... And I just wanted to, you know, I kind of also wanted to find out why I'm so screwed up in some ways.
Radio Gorgeous.
They meet after the war. Your father trying to go to medical school, etc. There was a Polish community in Scotland. And Liverpool, and then everybody gets uprooted.
And we go to Australia.
Yeah.
Well, I think that sort of force that propelled my father... I mean, he had to escape Poland. He was in a POW camp and he was liberated and then he fled to Britain. But he also just... He really wanted to get as far away from Europe as he could, you know. And in the Indigenous experience notwithstanding, Australia doesn't have that sort of knee-deep in blood and bone history that Europe has. And he said to my mum, you know, this is a new life. We start a new life here. And that's the sort of thing you can do in a colony like Australia to some extent. Although, of course, we have our own very complicated history too. He loved it. From the moment he got there, he absolutely loved it. And he just wanted this quiet life, you know. So much had gone on. So many of those men, you know, a lot of the gist of the story is the picture on the back cover of this incredibly suburban Australian existence and beneath that what was going on. But I think that's true of so much of the world, you know. These suburban-looking brick veneer houses and then the stories that are behind them and these men who just want to have these normal, normal lives after what they've been through. And it's about people who return from trauma and trying to kind of reach people who, you know, as the family of someone who's been so traumatised, how do you find the words to bridge that gap, you know?
And also, you know, I mean, he was able to not ask himself the questions or not be asked the questions. people living in Poland, like you saw when you went to Poland, visited your family, it's like they're still living with looking at neighbors who reformed or who did this, you know, and you're still living and you're still scrambling around.
Yeah.
You know, to try and make a living as well.
Well, look, I mean, the Poles went from, you know, this the history of Poland is like an object lesson in the destruction of tolerance, because Poland was known as the Jewish paradise in the like 13th, 14th century, and then it's really Catholicism and subsequent invasions that beat the multicultural tolerance out of them until they become what they are now. But look, it's really complex, Poland, and I think anyone in Europe is living with all of that. And now you talk to Poles and they're nervous about Putin, and Germany's their best friend. I mean, those allegiances, they shift all over the place. Europe's a funny bunch of tribes, isn't it? But you know, I feel for the Poles. I think they're constituted very psychologically and politically. They're very different from Russia. They have a real propensity for democracy, and they always have had.
Yes. Which is different
from the Tsarists. Yeah, and they don't hate the West, you know Russia, you know, I mean, Peter the Great tried to change that, but you know, Russia, they you know, I mean, Putin just is a Tsar, so you know.
Radio Gorgeous, the place to find authors.
One of the things that came out for me, and it's, you know, easy to look at things from the outside, obviously, when, you know, since you've laid it out so nicely for me, you know, I could do that.
Have at it.
But, you know, there was this whole, because the weight of Nazi Germany, in a way, was there was a pressure, direct pressure, coming through your father, and sort of anything that you tried to join, you didn't want to join too much. And yet you seem to be one of life's natural joiners. And wanting to get what you can positively from a collective.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, from quite a lonely childhood. Because your siblings, there's quite a gap between you and your older siblings. You know, so really wanting to be part of a tribe, a gang, and yet being scared of that.
Oh, terrified that I had the, you know, that I would have been one of the Hitler youth. I mean, Hitler and Nazi Germany is almost like a character in the book, really. Mm-hmm. It's an agent that is exerting pressure. It's the sort of, you know, the opposing force that's there just constantly, and that continued, you know, even though we went to, you know, the other side of the world. It still exerts a pressure, and you know, the whole thing was the fear of, you know, my father tried to leave history behind. He tried to be ahistorical. You can't, you know, you just can't. And I could feel all of that in the same way that kids are like dogs, you know, they sense what's going on. You don't have to be verbal about it for kids to know what's going on. And that I couldn't fully understand it. And that's why I had to sort of ask him so that I could get a grip on it. But, I mean, he was trying to toughen us up, to prepare us for, you know, the fact that history can take a very dark turn. It can do it very suddenly. And also he didn't want us to be weakling collaborators, you know. You had to be tough, you had to be brave, you had to be strong. And to do what his family did, you really freaking did, you know. And you had to be able to act. You had to be able to hide your emotions. It's interesting to me that my father and my uncle, both who were in that unit, produced daughters, both called Magda, my cousin Magda, who are actors. I wonder if there's, I don't know if there's any... You know, because my father was like he was a very real person, but there was almost a performative thing of like an Australian suburban man. he didn't quite get it right with his, you know, Bombay shorts, whistling, mowing the lawn he got right, but whistling Polish war songs was not typically Australian. Well, actually, the thing is, it is typically Australian, because Australia is so composed of migrants. You know, 49% of Australians have one parent born overseas, 20% of, you know, from migrant population. So it was, you know, it was trying to just understand how all that had sort of played itself out through me, I suppose, in my family.
You really did absorb both the intended and unintended lessons.
Yeah. Of that. Well, also, I think feeling skips a generation. You know, I think that there is a nature abhors a vacuum. You know, like my father would always say, because he never saw his parents again from the age of 20 because he couldn't go back to Poland. And he said, oh, I may be weird, but I never grieved for my parents. And he just, you know, a lot of people are like that. They just can't talk about this stuff. It's just too big. It's beyond therapy. You know, it's not like you can therapize them out of it. But as a child, you grieve. Like I used to grieve for my grandparents and for his loss of his parents, you know. So I was just this roiling mess of feeling all the unfelt feelings that he couldn't, you know, and he couldn't, in order to survive, it would have, you know, it would have destroyed him. So, but it, you know, it certainly, I seem to be the carrier.
Exactly. The water bearer.
Yeah. Someone's going to do it. Yeah.
But and that is this reckoning and an understanding of where some of your own emotional and mental struggles have come from.
Mm.
And I always wish for you,
mm-hmm.
and I think it seems like you're coming to the ability to forgive yourself as much as you have unstintingly forgiven everyone else in your life.
Yeah, I have. And that was one of the great things about writing the book. Because I had to really actually acknowledge my own fear and cowardice. And then, because especially given, you know, how brave my family were, in comparison, I'm like chicken shit, you know. And plus I was dealing with a very different kind of fear, which is that to do with my sexuality and being gay. And one of the things I say in the book is that for LGBTQI people, it's different from any other minority because in every other minority, the family shares a minority status. But as an LGBTQI person, you're a minority of one within your own family. And I was realizing that at the age of 5 or 6, and it's terrifying. It's terrifying because you know there's something that it's something that brings out disgust in people. You can see there's this uncomfortable feeling around it. You sense it, and it's very, very threatening. But I, you know, through writing the book, I realized that fear has its place. It's a normal feeling. I forgave myself for it, but I also re-examined. I filmed my father in 1997 and I went back and properly, like several times, listened to it. And I heard him differently. Like there were things that, you know, like that you don't hear at first or you're not ready to hear it all. And then the things that he actually said about courage were much more like, you know, that he really admired people who were shitting themselves but went ahead and did it anyway, you know. And I thought, well, actually, kind of, that is what I've done.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women, for women, radiogorgeous.com.
It's an interesting time for these kind of conversations, I think, because the forgiveness of fear is really important. But in other ways, we also have to take our courage in hand to stand up because there's a lot of... it's interesting that the discourse about what's going on politically in the world is about people are saying it's not the people of a particular political persuasion, they say it's fear. You know, mm-hmm. everyone's feeling that fear, and then it's like, well, I'm of the view you have to work at it to be more intelligent than your fear. It's okay to have it, but you can't let it rule you.
It's interesting. I want to go back to what you said, that your father's perspective, which I would agree with, is that politics can change at any moment, and I think we are.
Yeah.
Probably a week away.
Yeah.
From that moment.
Yeah, thank you, FBI.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, your father was a displaced person.
Yeah, totally.
And without, and he had, you know, a lot of similar experiences. There was a community set up and schooling provided for these displaced
But also persons. They turned and Jews away, they turned refugees exactly. away. I mean, there's but the same on, same on.
And then closed the school.
Yeah.
No more funding.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, so,
on your way, yeah, because halfway through his medical degree at Edinburgh University, they shut down the special Polish branch. which was devastating for him. I think there's been a shift in consciousness. I think we're not in that same 1930s Weimar Republic, because I don't think we can be. And I think we're seeing things just slight. I hope. I'm really hoping beyond all hope that it's a Jungian thing, that we're seeing the shadow and we're just going to have to cast the light on it, you know.
Okay.
But I think...
How? That, how are we doing?
Well, these kinds of conversations, I think. Mm. And that thing of understanding that it's fear and going, I just, you know, not shaming fear, but not giving it power either. It's a fine line, you know.
Yes, to acknowledge. Yes, well, we've always been scared of the other, and the other is scary. But
that's what we do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's kind of our gig.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the caveman.
Yeah.
You know, other
and,
is scary.
And, you know, I mean, really that lesson from Poland. I mean, I think Poland as a trajectory of the history of democracy and tolerance is a really interesting case study, because those sort of, it had a very multi-religious, multi-ethnic, very tolerant, you know, and it was these external forces, really, of invading powers. And then, my father used to speak scathingly of the Catholic Church because they were, you know, whipping up hatred of Jews in a shameful way. You know, we have to be aware of those factors that are operating, you know, because they have happened since time immemorial. But I'm hoping that this exponential thing happening with, you know, the internet, where I'm hoping we'll make some sort of leap, or I don't know. We're either going to destroy ourselves or we're going to get smarter. They really are the only two choices, aren't they?
I'm
to get along.
Smarter. Yeah. Because, you know, as we're living longer, making the same mistakes more frequently, clearly getting dumber. So I'm hoping something has to come along to address the balance.
Look, I'm hoping there'll be a tablet for it. Failing all else, I'm saying just Prozac in the water. Just so we've all got our heads above water, we're just operating at a basic sort of sane level, and then we can have conversations.
Yeah. Radio Gorgeous.
It seems to me that you sort of have also, as well as coming out as gay, you sort of have come out as Polish.
Yeah, good observation. I know, it's true. Because it's so weird, because my name in Polish, right, Magdalena Maria Teresa Szubańska, it is so Polish.
Yeah, you couldn't get more Polish.
Couldn't get more Polish. And it's like no one in Australia noticed. I'm like their girl. I'm like such an iconic Aussie character. And even the character that I probably, my most loved character, who's called Sharon Strzelecki. Strzelecki was a Polish explorer. And it's like people haven't really noticed it. But I kind of had inherited from my father, and I'm a half-blood, you know, I don't speak the language, and...
apparently, except when you're shit-blind drunk.
Then I speak it fluently, which is true of every language, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm very fluent in French, too, and I'm pissed.
Well,
you know,
that says you are, because you're...
You're disinhibited, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And grammar is an inhibitor.
Yeah, it's like grammar. I find that. I found that in my book, certainly. Yeah, you know, I tried to dispense with it as much as possible. What a that bloody nuisance. So it's... I think claiming my Europeanness, and... It's interesting because it's a few people in Australia have said it's a very European book, and I think it is. And I think the voice of it, actually, I think my writing voice is very European. It's not. I read it, and it's not Australian. I read other Australian literature, and I can feel that. I mean, I wasn't born in Australia. I'm very Australian, but I was born in Britain, and my family are European. Well, I have no Australian blood, you know. So it's kind of there. It's And I think that reclaiming of my Europeanness has been very important for me, which is hard when you don't speak the lingo, but you know.
Well, but also in the form of the book, and that's the self-reflective form of the book, and the fact that you know, as a young woman, you were ideologically mad.
Insane.
Give me my ideology.
Yeah.
I want
crazy for
I
it.
Need it.
Yeah.
And that's doesn't strike me as particularly Australian.
No, probably not. Mm-hmm. Not especially, no. No, I think there is a real, and it's, Australians don't really like you showing your smarts either. You know, there's a very anti-intellectual,
high poppy thing,
tall poppy thing. We're funny that way though. You know, we're sort of, I think everywhere kind of hates tall poppies.
Yeah.
I think it's human.
Show-offs.
Yeah, show-offs. Yeah.
Shut up and sit down.
Yeah.
Enough of you already.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's probably quite a healthy thing in many regards, but it has been a really a huge exercise in reclamation, actually, of so many parts of myself, and I'm wary of this whole thing of, you know, becoming your authentic self, because it's like, what was I inauthentic before? And it's like, whatever it was all part of the journey that was really necessary. To sound very hippie about it, but
well, and also, you know, who knows where you're going.
Who knows where
you're
going? Yeah.
This is
well,
you
also
now.
Too, you know, also too, it sort of shits me that you got it, because when I came out, I said I'm, you know, gay, a little bit not gay, because one of the reasons people say, why didn't I come out earlier, is because the gay community was very rigid about taking sides, and I understand that, but the idea of sexual fluidity, which is, in my case, is only minimal, but I didn't want to, I needed that to be said. The gay community has really evolved and is much more sophisticated and subtle in those understandings and forgiving, you
mm-hmm.
know.
As feminism has also moved on from the
enormously.
That,
you know, that was what, you know, when I was young working in a women's refuge, I used to get fits of the giggles because of the ideological constraints. Like, I kind of just, it was like being in church all the time, you know, and just, and that was part of why I had to leave. I don't mean like when the women were coming out, I mean the collective meetings. Because we had a collective and we had consensus, like nothing could be done without consensus. And there was one woman who was a really staunch socialist feminist, and she would just, you know, her morality was just like literally causing her to break out psoriasis all the time. And she couldn't let us buy toilet paper. I mean, like, the women and the kids, they need toilet paper, they need cornflakes. I know it's ideologically compromised, but they do want cornflakes. So we had to institute consensus minus one. Just a function. So it's, you know, it's, and we're living in that time again at the moment, this sort of righteousness. Oh, it's unbearable.
Really? Oh, really unbearable.
Yeah, because that, and we all want to do it because I think that's something I really learnt from my father. Like one of the, you know, because some people in Australia said, it's kind of almost like, oh, she's, why are you so tortured about it? It's kind of like a get over it attitude. And I'm like, well, hello, that is what PTSD is actually. You know, second generation is being tortured about this shit. But also there was a moral trauma that my father experienced, which was the loss of his belief in his own innocence and his goodness. And we all go around all the time thinking we're good people because we're never put to the test. And so there was a, you know, you can slide into a moral relativity. This stuff is so complex, isn't it? But that kind of... I think, you know, post 9/11, post the financial collapse, you know, and the you know, Wall Street getting away with it, everyone's wanting to get their moral act sorted out. But there is that kind of political correctness and that sort of vigilance about language can be really important because it forces people to not fall back into their privilege, as we keep talking about, check your privilege, but it can also just be so tyrannical sometimes. And it's also, sometimes people are just bullies with it. You know, I don't care if someone calls me a dyke or a lezzo. I honestly don't care. It's the intention, you know.
Exactly.
It really is. You know, if someone's going, you dyke, as opposed to, oh, you funny old dyke, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't really care. But it's, you know, but by the same token, you have to find some way to I know also when people are abusing that, you know, it's we're, you know, it's complex times.
It is, and it's not something that we can legislate, I don't think.
No.
And it's something that we have to personally negotiate.
You do, and also, like, it doesn't, you can't change language fast enough. If someone wants to be an asshole to you, they'll use whatever word.
Exactly.
You know, it doesn't matter.
It's like water seeing its own level. Assholes just find a way.
Yeah, you know I mean? That's
there's,
right.
There's always, in fact, you know, also, you know, even in Jungian and everything, there's types. There's the asshole.
Yeah.
You know,
and they persist, don't they? They persist. Yeah.
Exactly. Regardless of what we call it.
Yeah. But I do think there is a sort of a, I think young, I'm really hopeful about young people. I think there's a real sort of change of consciousness that's going on. And, you know, I'm choosing to be optimistic in some ways because with caution, but I think it's, to me, it feels morally responsible to be optimistic. You know, all right. Ultimately.
Well, I would say that was your Australian side, not your Polish side.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my father wanted me to evolve into that, and I completed his project, you know, because you look at the sixth, seventh generation Australians, and they don't carry that that European pessimism. And he didn't, actually. He was a really, you know, very life-loving man. You know, he had a great energy. He really did. But... You know, it's weird because I've also, at the same time as I've reclaimed my Polishness and my Europeanness, I've really kind of absorbed somehow that Australian optimism, mm-hmm. you know, that colonial kind of frontiers.
Mm-hmm. Up with people.
Yeah. We can do this.
We can do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, Aboriginal people. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, but I do like it just from the very beginning in your book. You do address that as well. Like, didn't hear a thing about the
not
places,
a thing. Seriously, you can live in Australia and never meet an Aboriginal person.
Yeah,
you know,
and never actually not even have a reference.
And that is totally, and that is one reckoning. Even though our Prime Minister said sorry, it hasn't been really internalized, absorbed, and internalized. And I think there's this sort of lag of Australia's origins as a convict nation, the pain and shame of that. They went sort of straight from the discourse of shame to the discourse of pride. And I think that that would have, you know, for some people it wasn't even that long ago. I mean, increasingly more distance. But there's a whole lot of stuff from... I mean, who of us really reckons with our history that well?
I'm just saying, we all have glorious bits of our past, and all have we've all, you know, every nation's been in the wrong.
Well, that's the thing when you do Who Do You Think You Are?
Yeah.
Absolutely. We are all descended from saints and sinners.
Exactly.
Every single one of us. You'll find a murderer in the closet. You'll find, a Mother Teresa. They're all there, and they're all mixed into our blood, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just have to try and find our own way. But it's, you can't, there's no one people or one, there's a tendency to want to idealise other nations or whatever, you know, but there isn't. We're all human beings. We're dark bastards, you know.
Yeah.
We've got that. And it was interesting that it was Joseph Conrad, the Pole, Heart of Darkness, that phrase, you know.
Keep your mind fit. Listen to Radio Gorgeous.
I'm just going to go completely off topic and go to Mitra.
Oh, yeah, right.
Because
the orangutan.
I thought, yes.
Yeah.
I thought he was the perfect... He had Polish courtly manners.
Oh, he did.
He did.
You're right, he did.
He was an old soul
yes.
Pole. Why you fell in love with him.
I did. He was amazing. And again, I'm aware that I'm probably projecting all sorts of a strange version of Noble Savage on, you know, that sort of trope. I was reading that thing the other day about how they're realizing that trees communicate. You know, this stuff is going
to
change us, isn't it?
It is. It
you
has
know,
to. We can't get away with this if we know.
I know that Bible shit about having dominion over the plants and the animals and that.
That was
you know,
mistake.
It really was, wasn't it? It's just
that
propaganda.
Messed,
it's
that
propaganda.
Exactly.
It really
messed us up.
It really did. Yeah. So hopefully we're coming out of that.
I can chat with you for hours, but you don't have hours.
I don't.
You
I'd love to keep chatting too.
I know, but I'm going to ask you because it really, I want people to get a flavor of the beautiful way that you write.
Author of the Week on Radio Gorgeous.
My mother's people. My mother comes from an ancient Catholic clan. Her people are Lamonts, originally Irish. The clan tartan is as sombre-hued as the Scottish sky, all dark greens and bruised blues, shot through with a thin, hopeful ray of white. Our people hail from the west coast of Scotland, where the Irish coast is so close you could practically stand on one shore and blow a kiss to your sweetheart on the other. Close, but far enough away to provide sanctuary too. The Irish Sea is furrowed with the wake of my ancestors' boats as they plied back and forth over the centuries, fleeing the wrath of the Protestant clans. Her mother, my grandmother Meg Lamont, was one of nine brothers and sisters, all of whom lived within walking distance of one another in Rosyth on the Firth of Forth, the dockyard town where the mighty Forth Bridge was built, and a mere granite stone's throw from Dunfermline, the ancient capital of Scotland and burial site of King Robert the Bruce, he of the famous try-try-again persistence. I would sit for hours while my mother lullabied me in her soft Scottish accent. Tales of her Irish father Luke and of Meg and of Auntie Bessie, fierce lion aunt and perennial spinster who had worked in service down in London. Of the great sack of money that sat on the shelf of my great-grandfather Henry Lamont's pantry among the baking soda and the treacle. And how Henry would send Auntie Bessie down to give a shilling to my gran when times were tough, even though he disapproved of my grandfather Luke, an Irishman like himself. My mother never knew why. Of the uncles, Tom, Ronald, Harry, Louis and Dan, and how one of them, Dan she thinks, lost a foot to the diabetes. How they were all musicians and how one of them, maybe Louis, played the big fiddle in an orchestra. Of the womenfolk, Jean Allen and Nell McLean, who my mother thought was full of life but whom Auntie Bessie always called Nell McLean, never Nell, on account of the fact that she was no better than she should be. Of her Irish grandfather Henry with his fine full head of white hair that he was so proud of and washed every day of his life. Henry, who helped build the Forth Bridge and who, thinking back, lost a foot as well, that must have been the diabetes. We are ever on the alert for dietary explanations for what ails us.
I can hear you calling. I can hear you calling. Talking to a tongue that heavy load, gonna rest my soul. That heavy load echoes in my soul. I can hear you calling, I can hear you calling, singing me to sleep some kind of peace, resting in my soul, that heavy load echoes in my soul.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women, for women, radiogorgeous.com.